I'm going to give the four of you the best compliment I can give under these circumstances, and this was absolutely enlightening. It was eye-opening. And I want to open the floor immediately to the public, given that we are a bit pressed for time. So if anyone has, and I expect you would, have questions, please use the microphone, and you can address any one of the panelists or all of them in concert.
Thank you very much. It was very enlightening. I really enjoyed it. But I have a different perspective that I'd like to propose. I think it might be helpful to back up a little bit and ask ourselves how we got in this situation in the first place. And there's many different ways you could approach that problem, but what I'd like to suggest is that we think about a shared folk theory of cosmology or an understanding of the way that world works, that we are every day enacting, and we embody that idea of what is right and sacred in our artifacts. And so you start with a sort of culture that produces a certain kind of landscape. The landscape reinforces those ideas. And so when you're faced with a problem like climate change in a culture that like we have where what is sacred is more material wealth and, you know, that we use instrumental rationality to address any problem that comes up, that really the problem is a little bit more complex than this rational actor model suggests. So, you know, voters look at climate change and they say, well, this is a threat to, you know, my idea of the inevitability of human progress. And you know, what I really want to do is have a bigger car and a bigger house and more vacations, and this is what I feel entitled to. This is the story that I've been told since I was born. So I just like to put that out there, and I don't know if anybody wants to respond to it, but...
Okay, so I've got several of you. I mean, I've done a lot of reading in the area that you're talking about, and actually the whole notion of stewardship and thinking about this and the way we approach it is, I think it's on the right track. You know, Speth's writing, Chaisson's writing, all these types of things you look at. We're not there yet. We're nowhere near that. And what you're really talking about is a complete societal change that we need to look at. But there are certain things that, for example, at a cultural basis that we can really start working on at the present time. I mean, we are in this mode. We're in this mode of the way that we do it. I mean, it's interesting to you. I mean, we did talk about the rational approach to the way to look at things, but we have a completely irrational approach right now in Canada. I mean, if anybody thinks that the debate over climate change in Canada is centered on the science, they're completely wrong. I mean, there's a whole disinformation campaign that's going on, all these various different things, and the average public really isn't, I mean, while they say in the polls that they're interested about climate change, the individuals, on an individual basis, when my experience talking to most people about climate change, they view it as somebody else's problem. Why isn't the government doing something about corporations? Why isn't the government doing something about this? But much of the stuff that we do is consumer-based, and that's why a lot of this stuff is produced. And one of the things is this really gets the behavioral aspects of a lot of our society. And one of the things that I would suggest that people look at is, you know, some of the stuff that's coming out of behavioral economics is actually quite interesting and maybe the basis to affect some of the change type. But there's one example from California, in a suburb in California, where they're doing control of electrical consumption. And in one neighborhood, they left it exactly the way they did. On the next neighborhood, they put meters in that actually had the kilowatt hour use that came up on the meter. There was about a 10% reduction in electrical. The next, across the road on the other side, the houses they put in there, they actually put in the kilowatt hours and the dollars And there was a 40% reduction when you actually saw the dollar sign on it. But the biggest reduction came is when the most sophisticated meters not only had your dollars, your kilowatt hours, but had the aggregate of your neighbors. And once you knew where you were relative to your neighbors, they got 80% reduction on this because they did not want to be above the mean. That's the really, so those kinds of changes I really think have to happen at the small scale collectively before we see a kind of change that you're talking about, which is getting it to the level of societal discussion about things like an alternate model to the type of model we have right now, where it is this trade-off type of economic analysis we do, cost-benefit analysis and all these types of things, maximizing our material profits and those types of things. If we're going to give value to the environment, it's not going to be in the monetary sense. I think environmentalism actually has been a disaster for the last three decades because it's tried to play that monetary game, and we lost. And we're going to continue to lose as long as we do that.
But things also have been won. Yeah. And society is not monolithic. There are attitudes of all stripes and ways in society. We've seen attitudes in the slides up here that characterize them in six sort of bins, that there are as many bins, if you want to have them, as there are people. But society as a whole, attitudes have changed, and they've changed dramatically, maybe not very rapidly, not as rapidly as we might like. But in our own lifetime, certainly my lifetime, and attitudes towards environment have radically changed. And I like to use this example in my conservation biology class. I show up a slide from the movie Bambi. You know, Bambi came out in just post-war. And in the film Bambi, Bambi grows up, and his mother is killed by a hunter. And this is terrible. This is a terrible thing in this movie. And that was a societal changer. It's a very popular movie. And to portray hunters as bad guys and that the deer are the ones you should root for really had an incredible impact. And it still reverberates today. We've come to through an era where the Endangered Species Act in the States was passed to save bald eagles and buffalo. And now we have, under that act and under the Canadian Act, jumping slugs are protected and frogs are protected, and that's okay. So attitudes change and have changed greatly over lifetimes and will continue to evolve. Continual pressure, continual knowledge, and societal changes. There'll be backtracking and people that don't believe it, but politics and policy in North American democratic societies, at any rate, is won by consensus and majority opinion, not by the rule of a few. So there is hope.
Our second question.
Yes, hi. Thank you very much. That was very interesting. Although I have to say it was a little bit discouraging, too, to hear some of the frustration that you've had during your career dealing with policymakers. And I'm not a scientist, so probably in my career I will not be necessarily on the defending scientific viewpoint, but maybe the opposite.
You might be on the other side.
I might be on the other side, who knows. And so I was wondering if, well, you've talked about policymaking at the highest level, so international and national, and with a lot of... we could feel a lot of confrontation because the issue at stakes are so different. I was wondering how much you believe in decision-making or policy-making at local level, where the elected people are so much closer to the place they live in and the community they live in, and if you think that this would be an efficient part of the solution, although obviously there's got to be bigger consensus, but at least an efficient part to create this momentum to engage citizens and make people feel as citizens.
Can I respond to that? It's extremely important to engage citizens at local level. So far as climate change impacts are concerned, the buck stops in communities, and communities need to be empowered. And they need to have a place in a policy framework that includes communities and includes province and includes the national and the international context. Very quickly, in Sudbury, we have what's called a climate change consortium, which has been built around the Conservation Authority. The Conservation Authority has the knowledge and the track record to be leading this exercise because they've been involved for the last 3 years in the most important role in source water protection and protecting drinking water sources against contamination. New Brunswick has moved ahead of Ontario and has legislation that protects source water at local levels. And it's involved, in fact, closing down gas stations in vulnerable watersheds. It's involved imposing setbacks on development of lawns and so forth, and the imposition of natural vegetation barriers on lake shores where homeowners are the shore dwellers. That source water protection exercise is an exercise in local communities, what can I say, implementing in a local way, not just a one-size-fits-all model, but implementing in a local way a broad policy established by the provincial government. I think it's an excellent example of citizens taking science and integrating science into the values of the community, and in fact community members making decisions in their community's best interests, not in individuals' best interests, but in community's best interests. It's an excellent example, and I'm hoping that the Climate Change Consortium, which is looking at greenhouse gas adaptation as well as emission reduction targets, strategies, implementation of policies, that will work equally well. It's extremely important that that local communities, the communities, be involved in a substantial and an influential way.
Thank you. Our next question.
With all due respect, despite many illuminating remarks, I think that the most important issue was not adequately addressed, namely the payoff for bad behavior. It seems to me that as many in the psychological and cognitive science fields have pointed out, that even dysfunctional behavior continues as long as the individual gains something from it. Now, most people, or certainly many, are aware that there are long-term penalties to be paid for immediate gains, but what the hell? Nobody knows the future. In addition to which, the science has presented in popular image a kind of paradigm that they're alchemists, that if you pour enough money and time, you can find the solution to everything, or at least that you can provide champagne at the price of beer. Now, this is a paradox because science tends to look at things in a longer-term perspective, in a wider perspective, but that's not the motivation of the average person and certainly not of policymakers. So it seems to me that the scientific paradigm runs against the paradigm, as was suggested, by many policymakers. So how does one overcome these conflicting paradigms? Where how can we, to use Professor Roulet's suggestion, how can science become more timely as far as the public is concerned? Because only if they can provide benefits that the public immediately sees will they get the support, and the both psychological and financial, that is required.
Okay, so who would like to? Norm?
Well, that's unanswerable, but I'll take my best shot. I think you're wrong. We heard that beliefs can change, and the changing of beliefs will correct bad behavior that pays off. We heard one example of that. My favorite example is how the city of Niagara Falls celebrated January 1st, 1900. The city fathers and mothers in their top coats went down to the waterfall at midnight, where there was a barge that had been released upstream containing all kinds of farm animals, and all those animals plunged to their death at the crack of midnight over the falls to the collective cheers of everyone in the town. This was Bambi gone wild, you know, and happened 50 years earlier. No one would consider doing anything like that today because beliefs change. People don't drink and drive anymore or nearly as much. Smoking is a social evil. Beliefs are more important, ultimately, than economics as drivers, I believe. And if we can influence people's beliefs, I think that will correct bad behavior. And I think we've seen a number of examples of that. But what scientists certainly are mistaken to believe is that just knowledge alone will be an appropriate corrector for bad behavior. I think you're correct there. But I think if we engage more broadly with our social science partners in this field and understand more about beliefs and perceptions and what David talked about differences within the public, that there is hope in changing bad behavior. That's my sense.
Just very quickly, MIT did some work on the support in the American public, or publics, for a price on carbon. And there is a majority support for a price on carbon. It seems to me that that is an essential element, whether it's through cap and trade or carbon taxes, but the fact is that the word taxes puts people off because of ideologies, that the fundamental part of combating bad behavior in climate change, where climate change is being caused, is a price on carbon, and the public is in support of that. The public is, and so are industry. There are industries that are lined up, waiting for the certainty, and waiting for the opportunity to in fact be trading on the basis of the carbon that they're able to save that is beyond what their cap would be. What we haven't got is we haven't got the political leadership to grasp this and put it into practice, at least not in this country. But I think if you listen to President Obama's speech, which is online, you will find that you've got somebody who is indeed able to articulate the fact that there needs to be a change in the way that we treat the atmosphere.
Just a very brief reminder, rejoinder, and I won't be long. Admittedly, we know there's a link between smoking and cancer, and admittedly, smoking has declined. However, only 20% of smokers get cancer. But because smoking became the target, all the other causes for cancer are ignored largely because it's now, in other words, a little knowledge can also be a dangerous thing. In other words, we're not worried about all kinds of environmental things at work, at home, etc., because after all, it's smoking that causes all the problems. So I wish that I could agree with the panel but I'm a little skeptical.
Well, I don't know where you get your information about cancer from, but I don't believe what you just said.
Nigel, did you want to say something?
No.
Okay.
It was going to be on the same.
Okay, thank you very much. Let's move on to the next question, please.
Hey. Okay, I just have a question, kind of on an ethical side, about something that I've been kind of grappling with. I just wanted to hear your opinion about how we can deal with the ethics of controlling and remediating climate change on a global level, like through the ICC, when there are such huge disparities between industrialized and developing nations. And we've already gone through industrialization, and we have caused a lot of the damage. So how can we ask them to hold off on developing? And how do we reconcile that with the very urgent and real need of doing something about global climate change? That's
yeah. I think this is on. I'm going to say something that may seem a heresy to a lot of people, but I don't think the IPCC is exactly the best instrument tool for being able to affect change on these things. I think the IPCC served a very, very important purpose of being able to give what most people would consider an insurmountable body of evidence that the problem is real. The IPCC didn't change its tune. We said the same damn thing in the 1995 report that we said in 2007 with a few word changes. That's it. I mean, the body of evidence was there. There was a sea change, though, with the 2007 report because I think people finally said, okay, well, the most bulk of people said. The IPCC has also suggested a bunch of different potential solutions in a very kind of neutral, almost what I call a wet noodle sort of way, because the fact is that they're trying to reach consensus over these things. I think to elaborate a bit on what David was saying in answer to another question, if you look at the really effective dealing with climate change or the climate change issues, greenhouse gases and those sorts of things, it is at the local level that almost all the action and the meaningful action is being done. And it's being done not because of climate change itself, but it's being done because people are examining the issues of greenhouse gases as being a waste product for the way that we do things. And there are lots of additional benefits. So, for example, there's one project that I have been advising a little bit on, which is methane from rice paddies in southern India. The farmer in India couldn't care less about greenhouse gas emissions, but by controlling certain aspects of the greenhouse gas emissions, it actually reduces the need for as much water. And that's the key issue. The key issue is water. So you can actually frame an awful lot of these things at the local level where the real payoff and the benefit is for the individual that they can actually feel, but the benefit for the globe, you might think, at the kind of IPCC level is it reduces emissions. And we're going to reduce emissions by billions of small cuts here and there, not by overall, I think, top-down policies are going to... The top-down analysis is a complete failure to date. Even the EU, which trumps out how successful they've been on this, they really have not been very successful. What they've done is that most of the EU's success is due to accounting. And, in fact, a lot of the things that they actually champion have put in perverse economic things in it, where you've got people actually investing in higher-emitting processes because, in fact, they get credits through those types of things. So I think it's got to be at the bottom level, grassroots, work up at the individual. Policy can guide it from maybe an overall target of wanting to reduce emissions, but I really do think it's got to be at the local level.
Could I just emphasize a point that Nigel raised there? The kinds of policies that will be successful are co-benefit policies. Co-benefit policies. The Chinese are looking at that. Do you know where the biggest investment in solar energy development is taking place? It's not in the United States. It's in China. Do you know where there's more percentage of wind power? It's in China. That's right, because of the health benefits. It's the co-benefit policies and partly the economic benefit policies. What the Chinese are seeing are the opportunity to export technologies, to sell it to the slow-moving United States, to sell the technology that the U.S. needs in order to meet its emission targets.
Even slower Canada.
And even slower Canada. It's when you begin to seriously reframe, not to spin the issue, but to reframe it as an energy and innovation issue, that you begin to see the co-benefit policies that will work, in fact, for those people in the middle of the spectrum, the ones that are can be moved to the committed end of the spectrum if you develop the co-benefit policies which appeal to them. The coal industry will be appealed to by the development of carbon sequestration technologies and efficient coal burning technologies that MIT is looking at. Get them on side with co-benefit policies. And don't talk about climate change. Talk to publics, talk to the local communities about changing climate. Shift the words around. They can see the climate changing. They can talk to their mothers and fathers and their grandfathers and so forth. And family stories will convince them that the climate is changing. Get them on board by talking about adapting to the effects, the impacts of severe events. And you've got them involved in the game. Get them in the game through what they can see and not through asking them to believe in a science, an abstract science concept of climate change.
Now, one of our panels has to leave very soon, so we have time for one question. I hope it can be quick. Sorry.
Unfortunately, I missed most of it, so I'll focus on the last presentation, on the term of evidence-based or evidence-informed. I've been in a group that has done some work on evidence as it is used by the World Trade Organization in order to justify trade barriers. And personally, I think we should take a much broader approach and look into both environmental and economic considerations. The linkage between ecology and economics, I like to call Ecolomics. In fact, that little group has created a website, Ecolomics International, with an NGO, and you can Google it and you'll get it right away. I'm not sure that the site shows already that that group has moved to Montreal a few days ago. So I think evidence, like Nigel mentioned, is also consumer behavior, for instance. It's a very fundamental, or industry behavior, or political facts on the ground. These are all parts of evidence. So I think we have to look much more than the media do normally, either on ecological issues or on environmental issues. We have to link the two, ecological or economic issues. The key, I think, is the way how we integrate or don't integrate the two very different spheres.
Well, thanks for that. The quote from Philippe Couillard just seems so much of a surprise to our thinking as scientists, where we would automatically say, well, it has to be based on evidence that, and not just informed by it. And you're quite right, because in the policy sphere, what you base the your policy on is not simply probabilities, p-values, and that sort of evidence, but all manner of other sorts of inputs, including policies and social policies from political parties and various other stances. So the issue becomes very, very complex, and it becomes part of the difficulty of scientists understanding what happens to their evidence, what happens to their scientific study they worked very hard on, present this, and it is used partly or not at all, or is thrown into the mix with these other forms of, you can call them evidence, or other forms of informing policy, and wonder what happened to it. My whole point was that scientists, once they, if they want to enter into this sphere to be part of it, have to know what the rules are. And the rules of discourse and the rules of the game in policymaking are very different and surprisingly different from the rules of doing science.
And the rules of this panel, if I have to call it to an end. Thank you very much to our speakers, to our panelists. We actually have gifts for them.
I hope they low carbon footprint.